Today's March 20th. It's Tuesday morning at the Keep Academy. We usually learn, of course, Parshat Shavua, but I had a choice. Should we learn the Parsha, which is the beginning of the book of Leviticus, Sefer Vayikra, Parshat Vayikra, or should we focus on the upcoming holiday of Pesach? And I thought that it's more relevant to the people around the table to focus on Pesach. That's what we're going to do. Next week is our last class before the break, and probably then we'll focus also on Pesach. Let's talk a minute about the calendar. So next week is our last class before the break. Then we have 3 weeks that I'm in Israel.
Okay.
We have 3 weeks and I'm in Israel, and we'll be coming back here on Monday the 23rd, I think it is. 23rd or 24th.
April.
April, yeah. April the 24th will be the first class after Passover. So with that information, we can now begin learning. What we're going to do is open up to the verses in the Torah that provide us with the foundation for the celebration of Pesach, for the celebration of the Seder. And after we see the verses that talk about the foundations, we're going to see how the Haggadah develops those foundations. So it all goes back to chapter 12 of Exodus. And the chapter 12, while we're opening it up, I'll tell you the background and the context, which is very important. The Israelites have been slaves in Egypt for at least 210 years. And Moses, of course, was sent by God to take them out of slavery. And Moses affects, as a agent of God, 9 plagues. Not 10, but 9. The reason I say 9 is because on the eve of the 10th plague comes chapter 12. So when we read chapter 12, we have to know that only 9 plagues have been affected so far. There's one more to come. At the end of chapter 11, before we get to chapter 12, God already said to Moshe, tell Pharaoh there's going to be one more plague, and then he's going to send you out. And we shall understand, according to tradition, that chapter 12 here, again, on the eve of the 10th plague, between the 9th and the 10th, chapter 12 was spoken on the first day of the month that later became the Hebrew month of Nisan. That's when this was spoken. Here we go. We're going to read chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. In the book of Exodus. The Lord said to Moshe and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall mark for you the beginning of the months. It shall be the first of the months of the year for you. That's all we'll focus on for the next 5 or 10 minutes. Now, this verse, notice it's a rather poetic, bombastic, uplifting formula. It says the same thing twice in different language, right? This month shall mark for you the beginning of the months. And then again, it shall be the first of the months of the year for you. It's the same thing twice. In other words, it's a big moment, an important moment. It's in poetic language. It's some uplifting language, lilting language. What is it trying to say? That this is the beginning. Everything is going to begin anew from this point, because until now you've been slaves, now you can become free men and women, and as a embodiment, let's say, an expression of that freedom, your calendar is going to be different. You're going to have a calendar that begins from the moment at which you became free. And it's very important to note that in both halves of that sentence, sentence 2, the phrase for you appears. In Hebrew, lechem, for yous, for you all, in Texan, right? It's in the plural, and it's saying that for you all, for the Jewish people, for this group of slaves and their descendants, it's going to be a calendar that's different than the calendar of the rest of the nations, and different from the calendar you have used until now. That's going to be your particular Israelite calendar that marks your birthday. As a collective, not as individuals, but as a collective, when the Jewish people are born. Let's now see what two important commentators say about that verse. We're going to look at the Rashbam and look at Rashi. Rashi, if you remember, is in the 10th, 11th centuries in Ashkenaz, northern France. And his grandson, the son of his daughter, is the Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, who's living about 50 years later, approximately, in the same basic area. And the two of them had contact. Rashbam showed his commentary in the Torah to Rashi. They knew each other very well. We're going to see their commentaries, both of them, on this verse. So first the Rashbam, he says the following. According to Rabbi Eliezer, who says that the world was created in Tishrei, etc. I have to give some background. He's quoting from the Talmud. And the Talmud is quoting from earlier material from before the year 200. And there's a machloka, there's a disagreement between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. And the disagreement is, when was the world created? When was the world created? Nothing to do with the Exodus yet. And in that disagreement, Rabbi Eliezer says the world was created in Tishrei. Tishrei, that's the month today we call Tishrei, in the fall, right? That's when our holiday of Rosh Hashanah falls. And I want to explain why Rabbi Eliezer holds that the world was created in Tishrei. It's not a scientific statement, obviously, but it is an empirical statement. It's an empirical statement, and I'll explain why. Most of us know, probably, that there's a very clear hydrological cycle in the Middle East, in Israel and in the land surrounding Israel.
Water.
I could be saying that wrong. Hydrological, right?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's
perhaps
the
I made
first
it up.
Time I
perhaps I made it up. You never know. With me, you never know. In the winter, it rains, and only in the winter. By the time you get to March, April, the end of the winter, spring, the rain stopped falling. When the rains stop falling, the cisterns are now full, hopefully. But as the months go on, the cisterns become more and more empty, obviously, as human beings take water out of the cisterns. At the same time that the summer begins and the rains are not falling, the cisterns are becoming lower and lower. That's the same time that the crops are harvested and taken out of the fields. In March is the barley harvest. In April, about 7 weeks later, is the wheat harvest. The minute the wheat and the barley are harvested, the fields are now empty. There's only one crop a year. At least that's the way it was 2,000 and 3,000 years ago. The fields are now brown. There's no rain. The trees, on the other hand, are blooming. You have April, May, June. In July, the middle end of the summer, the trees begin to bear their fruit in a ripened form, and it's picked. We're talking about the pomegranates. That's already in September. We're talking about the grapes in September, the figs and the dates in August, September. The olive harvest, actually, I'm not sure. That's why I'm not mentioning it, exactly when it works. I think it's the same time, but I don't want to commit myself because I didn't look it up. By the time you get to August, not only the fields barren, not only the cisterns almost empty, but the trees have no fruit in them anymore. It's all been picked. And the sensation, the feeling, the experience of someone who's living in this period, at this time, in this place, is that the earth is dying. And indeed, if it doesn't rain by the end of September or October, literally, there'll be no water left in the cistern, there'll be nothing to drink, there'll be nothing to give to your children, and the world will die. Almost in a literal sense. When the rains fall again, whether the end of September or in October, sometimes the beginning of November, when the rains first fall, literally the whole earth comes to life. Within a day or two, you see everything turns green from being brown. And then the cycle begins again. Now the fields are moist enough to begin plowing, and then it's planting, etc., etc., etc. So therefore, the experience of a farmer, and that's of course 95% of the people in ancient times, is that the earth is dying and comes to life again in the fall. Which means that every year the earth is quote unquote created in the fall. That's an empirical experience. Now if you extrapolate backwards, if the world is created in the fall this year, it was the same last year, the same last year, the same the year before, go back thousands of years, the world must have been created in Tishrei. That's where the opinion comes from, that the world was created in Tishrei. So that's what Rabbi Eliezer says. The world was created in Tishrei. And then he goes on
but
to say...
Why Rabbi Yeshua would not agree with it?
I was hoping not to go into that. But Rabbi Yeshua, I'll just say one sentence, conflates the Jewish experience with the universal experience. As he doesn't live universally, only lives Jewishly. Let's say it like that, I think. Whereas Rabbi Eliezer lives in two worlds, as we're about to explain.
So Rabbi Yehoshua says Nisan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if Israel was in the southern hemisphere, it
opposite of being.
I think you're right. I would say that you're right.
Yeah.
So according to Rabbi Eliezer, who says that the world was created in Tishrei, the straightforward sense of our verse would be in essence as follows. Though it is not the beginning of the months for other nations, it shall be for you. And of course, for you, we saw, appears twice in our verse. To enumerate the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, up to the 12th month, that is the month of Nisan. You must start counting with this month.
Adar.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're right.
Yeah.
Adar. You must start counting with this month as a reminder that in this month you went out of Egypt. When the Torah says in the 7th month, it means the 7th month after the month of the Exodus from Egypt. And wherever the Torah mentions a month, it's always by number and not by name. And it's always the number of months since the Exodus. Whether it says the 1st month, the 5th month, the 10th month, the 12th month, in the Torah and in the Tanakh, in most of the Tanakh, in the later books of the Tanakh, they do start using, of course, names. But in most of the Tanakh, and certainly in the Torah, it's all numbers from the Exodus. So, the point here is that the nations of the world, and of course we mean the nations of the Middle East, count time from creation, from the fall. That's the first month in the fall, what we would call Tishrei. Whereas the Jewish people presumably had that calendar until now, but now they have a different calendar, a calendar that marks the national rebirth, the birth of the Jewish people as an independent people. Now, I just have to say parenthetically that...
Rebirth or birth?
Rebirth. Well, you can say actually birth. And every year, it's our rebirth. Every year when we celebrate our birth, we're celebrating our rebirth. Like when you celebrate a birthday, it's your rebirth every year. You're coming one step further.
Birth in the sense that the covenant was first given at Sinai, and that's when, you know, the modern state of Israel really...
So you know what?
No, then it's
not exactly.
I meant by the leaving Egypt.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's the physical birth.
Because if it was in Sinai, it should have been Sivan.
Right, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So I'll just mention parenthetically, it's not our subject, that you could have gotten the impression from this that this new calendar completely replaces any old calendar.
Right.
But we know that's not the case. We know that the Torah super adds this calendar onto the old calendar, but doesn't replace the old calendar. That the Jewish people end up living according to two calendars, at least according to Rabbi Eliezer. That the old calendar that says the year begins in Tishrei remains, but a new calendar is super added to that, that says the year begins in Nisan. That's why today we celebrate Rosh Hashanah in the fall. That's not the Jewish New Year. That's the universal New Year. Whereas in the spring, Pesach, that's the Jewish New Year. I can say it in a different fashion that makes it clearer. From a Jewish point of view, Tishrei is the universal New Year, whereas Nisan is the collective New Year. I can say that differently to make it even clearer. Universal means that there's no distinctions between the different human beings. Therefore, universal is equivalent to individual. Tishrei is when individuals celebrate the new year. Nisan is when the collective celebrates the new year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say that again in different language. Tishrei is the time that a Jew stands before God as an individual and assesses his moral standing. Nisan is the time that a Jew reassesses his standing as a member of the Jewish people. Not as an individual, but rather Nisan is the time of the reaffirmation of Jewish identity. It's when the people is born, and therefore it's the time in which I renew my vows to the people. which is very different than Tishrei. Tishrei is about my individual moral standing before God. How did I do with this mitzvah? How did I do with this moral act? How am I doing as a human being before God? Not necessarily asking myself, how do I stand vis-a-vis the people of Israel? Whereas it's something else in Nisan. Nisan is the affirmation of Jewish identity, the rebirth of the Jewish people.
It's interesting that I was always wondering why Passover is more centered around the home and Rosh Hashanah is centered more around synagogues. It should have been kind of the opposite.
Home's more individual.
Yes.
The simple answer is go back to the way it used to be and was supposed to be. Pesach was centered around the Beit HaMikdash, when all of Am Yisrael is there at one time, camping out around the temple. Whereas Rosh Hashanah is not a pilgrimage festival, that's every person in their town. Right?
So we should reverse it.
Everyone should go to Israel for Pesach. Perhaps not come back to Dallas, but certainly go to Israel for Pesach. Okay. So after saying that, we're going to look now at Rashi, at Rashi's commentary. Again, Rashi is the grandfather of the Rashbam, and it's on the sheet I prepared. Rashi's commentary is first on that word month. The verse had said, "This month shall mark for you the beginning of the months." And when I translated this, I wrote month/moon, because the Hebrew word for month also can mean moon. Ha-chodesh hazeh, this chodesh, and in biblical Hebrew, chodesh can mean not only month but moon. That's why the word means month, because it first means moon, and the month comes from the moon. And Rashi is going to work on that word, its double meaning, month-moon. Rashi says, God showed him, him is Moshe, God showed him the moon at its renewal, and said to him, when the moon renews itself, let that be for you the beginning of a new month. So in other words, it's not merely that God is saying that this month, Moshe, is going to be the first month of the year, but God is pointing out it's exactly how the moon looks in the sky now, that's going to be the beginning of every month. And then we're going to skip down to the word this, where Rashi says the following. Moshe had difficulty regarding the renewal of the moon, how much of it must be visible so that it be fit to be consecrated. God then showed him with his finger, and it means God's finger, by the way, the moon in the sky, and said to him, when you see it like this, sanctify it. What's going on here is the following. There's a rabbinic fundamental custom of rabbinical assumption that whenever you find the word this noun, right, this book, this moon, this building, it means pointing to it. And what do you mean this or that in English? It means pointing to it.
You mean hazeh or zeh?
Hazeh. Ha-chodesh hazeh. So when it says here, ha-chodesh hazeh, this moon, this month, so that brings the rabbis to the creative assertion that God must have been pointing at the moon with his finger. Why would God do such a thing? Perhaps because Moshe didn't really understand, so God had to point out on the board what the moon looks like when it's time to renew the month. So when you see the sliver in the sky, it looks exactly like that, that's when the new moon is, not a day later. Now, so what's going on here? Why does Rashi have to emphasize that it's not just that this month is the new month and it's the beginning of the year every year, but it's exactly as the moon looks right now? And again, I said earlier, the assumption is that this verse is being stated the first day of the month when the moon renews itself in the sky. Rashi apparently is emphasizing how exact this matter has to be. So let me explain what I mean by this exactitude. The Jewish people now are being given a new calendar, a new way of counting time. And according to Rashi, this calendar has to be based on exactitude. You have to get exactly right when the month begins. And the point is that from a certain point of view, from a Jewish point of view, time is being born. Time is being born. What do I mean? I mean that a slave doesn't live in the dimension of time. Just think of that. What does time mean? It means time is precious. It means I'm afraid of every moment that slips away, that I want to accomplish certain things. If I don't accomplish them, well, the clock is ticking. And every day, therefore, is different, and a day that's lost will never come back. A slave does not have that experience. A slave has the opposite experience. He wants the time
to pass.
He wants to kill time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Human beings, real human beings, free human beings, want to save time. Slaves want to waste time. They don't have time. It's a completely different experience. So as the Jewish people now are going from slavery to freedom, and this of course is spoken, like we said, on the eve of the last plague that will bring us to freedom, this mitzvah, according to Rashi's interpretation, is not just you're going to have a different calendar. It's that you're now here to celebrate time. Pesach is really the celebration of the birth of time. The birth of freedom and the birth of time are the same thing. And this relates a little bit to what we talked about vis-a-vis matzah about 5 weeks ago. I mentioned that the symbolism of matzah, did we do that?
Yes,
we did that, right? The double symbolism of matzah, that matzah as the bread of freedom is because we didn't have time for the dough to rise. In other words, we had an experience that there wasn't enough time. Slaves don't have that experience. That was a new experience. That I'm concerned that I don't have time. The time is passing. And matzah symbolizes the preciousness of time. That you only have a little time to make it. So matzah symbolizes the pressure of the preciousness of time. And this whole holiday is about the birth of time and the sanctification of time.
So that's where Heschel gets this thing of time?
Very good, right? He focuses on Shabbat. But the Torah really here is about the sanctification of time. The birth of the Jewish people is about the sanctification of time. And that philosophical framework, the words of Rashi are really, really, I think, relevant. I just have to turn off my phone.
So Rabbi, based on what you're saying, the way that the verse should read is, this month shall be for you the beginning of months. Because he's pointing at the moon at the time when he refers to the word month.
This moon shall be for you.
This moon shall be the... Exactly.
Yeah,
this moon.
Yeah. That's okay. What Rashi says.
Okay.
That's what Rashi says. Thank you for focusing on that. Good. Okay. So...
with all the emphasis on time and the way the Jewish people have kept it, does that make the calendar, the traditional calendar of time, instead of how long, more reliable? Or is this just... or do we not
more reliable?
Mm-hmm. Compared to other calendars, which seem to switch, where time isn't as concrete, it seems like, or kept.
No, like, it's more private.
The original calendar was based on the sighting of the new moon every month. We no longer have that, and we have a calculation, and there is a certain loss of a few seconds every year in the calendar. I don't have to proclaim that our calendar is better than anyone else's calendar. It's just our calendar.
No, I'm talking about with the keeping of history. If Rashi's here emphasizing the moon and Shabbat is something that is kept every week, and the various holidays throughout the year, it seems like the storing of historical information would be a little bit easier to pinpoint than perhaps in a different calendar system.
I'm not exactly sure, unless you mean that the very flow of time reminds us of our history. But it's the same thing. For example, the Christian calendar reminds people, at least it's supposed to, of the birth of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So our calendar reminds us of our birth, the birth of our people. Okay, so I want to look at some other verses in this chapter. that set out the foundations of what later comes the Seder. Tony?
You know, there's an incredible amount of confusion about something, and that is that if the calendar, the Jewish calendar is lunar-based, and you take the Julian calendar and you put it with it, surely there comes a point in time at which, based upon the moon, the Jewish, the true Sabbath doesn't correspond necessarily with the Julian Sabbath, you know, because...
Okay, I'll explain. There's absolutely no connection between the Shabbat and the calendar.
Okay.
Right. Shabbat comes every 7 days without any reference at all to the moon.
Okay.
Completely, completely unrelated. Completely unrelated. Shabbat is a celebration that goes back to the creation of the natural world, whereas the calendar, Passover, is a celebration that goes back to the creation of the collective historical experience of the Jewish people. The two are not related. The two are not related. Right? You can have Shabbat without the historical events that the Jewish people celebrate. You can have the historical events without the Shabbat, in theory. So, in chapter 12, we're going to read on now from verse 3 to 10. Speak to the whole community of Israel and say that on the 10th of this month, and this is the month that will be called later Nisan, in the spring, each of them shall take a lamb to a family, a lamb to a household. But if the household is too small for a lamb, let him share one with a neighbor who dwells nearby. In proportion to the number of people, you shall contribute for the lamb according to what each household will eat. Which means you have to get together a group of people that can basically eat a lamb in one sitting. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a yearly male. You shall take it from the sheep or from the goat. You shall keep watch over it till the 14th day of this month. That's 14 days later. And all the assembled congregation of the Israelites shall slaughter it at twilight, which means in the afternoon before the sun goes down. They shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the houses in which they are to eat it. They shall eat the flesh that same night. They shall eat it roasted over the fire with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. Do not eat any of it raw or cooked in any way with water, but roasted, head, legs, and entrails over the fire. Okay. So, what's going on here? This is the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach, the sacrificial lamb, the Paschal lamb. And as we probably mentioned in classes in the past, if not a few weeks ago, then a year ago, if not a year ago, then 2 years ago, if not 2 years ago, then three or four or five, the lamb was one of the many gods of the Egyptians. That's clear from the Torah, at least two different passages. It's called Toeva, which means set aside for holiness or set aside for abomination. In this case, set aside for holiness. The Egyptians worshipped the lamb, and we know from verses in the prophets, and we know from the Midrashim, that the Israelites, to a large degree, became idolaters. They sunk into idolatry during the 210 years in slavery. And if that's so, that means many of the Egyptians and many of the Jews worship this god, the lamb. And now the mitzvah is to kill it. And the significance of that is that this is a matter of civil disobedience, of religious disobedience. This is a matter of repudiation of the religion of the culture you've been part of, and a repudiation of the religion that you yourself may have accepted upon yourself. You, repudiation is the bitul. Bitul. Hitrachakut. And the question is, are the Israelites able to do it or not? It wasn't an easy thing to do. It would be equivalent today to being commanded to take the American flag and burn it. And where to burn it? On your front lawn. Because what does it say here? It says, take the lamb on the 10th of the month, hold it in waiting until the 14th of the month, which means have it on your front lawn, show the whole world you're about to do something to the god of the Egyptians. And then you're supposed to slaughter it in broad daylight. Then you're supposed to take the blood and smear it on your door, which is like taking the ashes of the flag that you burnt on your front lawn and smearing them on your doorpost, saying to the whole world, this is my feeling vis-a-vis the American flag. The Midrash says that most of the Israelites were not able to do this, and they preferred to not fulfill the mitzvah and stay in Egypt. The Midrash says only 1/5 left Egypt. Only one-fifth actually did this. And the Midrash probably is a metaphorical way of explaining to us how difficult it was. It was meant to be difficult. This is a question of, who am I? Am I going to be an Egyptian and stay in Egypt? Or do I want to be a Jew? Do I want to be a Jew with all the difficulties involved, with all the questions and the doubts? Where are we going to go? And who is this Moshe guy? And can we depend upon God? And how can we escape from the Egyptians? I understand God did these 9 plagues, but can we rely on Him tomorrow and the next day and the next day? What are we going to do? So, it's an act of civil disobedience. Also, of course, that explains what has to be roasted over an open fire and not boiled, because it makes a lot of smoke and a lot of smell. That's why it has to be roasted head, legs, and entrails. Yes. One big thing.
And you eat the whole, and the entrails too, which is unusual for Jewish kashrut.
I don't. There's nothing inside there. That's nothing that you can't eat, there except the sciatic nerve.
No vidan Hashem, no nothing.
Good, except for that.
Okay. Certain fats.
But it says you roast it, and say you eat it.
No, you say.
No, the next. You do eat it. Yes, it says you eat it. You eat the whole thing.
Innards included.
And of course, that's the whole reason that you make this chavura. You get enough people that you'll know will be able to consume the whole thing. Okay, so anyway, that's the meaning of the Paschal Lamb. It's an act of repudiation of Egyptian idolatry and the extrication of the individual from that morass to become a servant of God. Let's go to the verse we read already, verse 8. Read it again. They shall eat the flesh that same night. They shall eat it roasted over the fire with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. That's the matzah and the maror. And to make a long story short, the bitter herbs, of course, symbolize the bitterness of slavery. This is the last meal of slaves. Because as they're eating this meal, after the sun goes down at the end of the 14th of the month, becoming the 15th of the month, they eat the meal, and at midnight, there's going to be the 10th plague, the firstborn. Paro's going to come and say, get out of my land immediately. So this is the last meal of slaves.
Why not cooked, but roasted?
Because when it's roasted, it makes a lot of smell and a lot of smoke, I think.
And back to what you were saying about time, roasting is a faster method of cooking. You just take the meat and put it over the fire as opposed to preparing it and boiling it. Or
In this, I don't know if you have one big lamb all together. I think it takes quite a while to
roast. Do you take longer to boil it, though?
No, I have no idea. Americans do it almost all night, no?
I don't know. Yeah. Should Americans do it? How long it would take, I don't know.
I've seen some movie and it looks like it took them...
takes all night long.
The whole night.
To roast the whole thing together, yeah.
So that couldn't be the case here, because by midnight
Or maybe,
they left.
But at least a few hours.
A few hours.
Just showing part rare meat.
So that is the bitter herbs. And of course the matzah symbolizes slavery. Remember we had said in our class 5 weeks ago that matzah is a double symbol. It becomes, at the Exodus, the symbol of freedom, but until then it was the symbol of
poverty.
Of poverty and slavery. They ate it as slaves. So this is the last meal with the bitter herbs and the unleavened bread symbolizing the slavery that they've experienced for so many years, and they eat it together with the Paschal Lamb, which symbolizes the extrication from Egyptian culture, Egyptian idolatry, Egyptian religion.
So the lamb is very much like the matzah, transforming food. It transforms through the Seder.
It doesn't transform. Its meaning doesn't change, but it symbolizes a transformation. Whereas the matzah itself undergoes a transformation in its significance.
So why is that still not the tradition to eat the lamb?
So what happened is, to make a long story short, the halakha interprets the Paschal Lamb as a sacrifice like any other sacrifice, and understands it has to be brought in the temple. And that's why in ancient times, until the destruction of the temple in the year 70, for... Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam oseh maaseh bereishit.
Amen.
That's the... Wow. Yeah. The lightning and thunder you guys have in Texas is not like in Israel. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam shekocho u'burato malei olam.
Amen.
I was thinking of the Song of Boaz.
You don't have this in Israel, thunder and lightning like that.
Yeah.
And what's the connection with the lamb or goat that the Jews always use as a sacrifice? I mean, Abraham killed a goat instead of Isaac.
A ram.
Yeah.
I don't know of a connection in the past, but it becomes connected in that this sacrifice becomes one of the temple sacrifices. That's what I was about to say before the thunder and lightning. So let me finish the thought. So this sacrifice is assimilated into the sacrifices of the Beit Mikdash of the temple, so that the halakha was that on Passover, the whole family, all the Jewish people, come to the temple to bring the sacrificial lamb in the temple. That's where it is slaughtered, and parts of it are put on the altar in the temple, and then everyone gets their lamb back, minus the parts that have been put on the altar, and goes to their campfire and roasts it, as it says. When the temple was destroyed in the year 70, so the halakha understood there's no longer a possibility of bringing the sacrificial lamb. And therefore we have the seder every year without it. We have the shank bone as a zech, as a memory of it, but we don't actually eat it. Because we want to remind ourselves that we don't have a temple, we don't have therefore the real thing. So our seder every year, since the year 70, is really missing the central element.
Wow.
But theoretically, assuming that the temple was in existence, with all the respect to vegetarians, that means that it is actually a mitzvah on this one day to go ahead and eat lamb. It's commanded in Torah.
On the face of it, you're right. Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, has a response, and he says that in the future, when the temple is rebuilt, it may be that the sacrifices will be transformed to a higher level, and only from the plant kingdom, and not from the animal kingdom.
Please excuse me, Bob. I just
no. And I thought that all of the festivals would be gone, except for
Purim. Meat.
That's a different midrash.
Right. They made on artificial.
Okay, let's.
We can sacrifice to.
Let's go on. So we're still in chapter 12. After talking about the Paschal Lamb, the bitter herbs, and the matzah, we get to the next element of the Seder that's mentioned here in our verses. We have to go on to verse 24 to 27 in the same chapter. By the way, we didn't read the verse, which is important. I neglected this, that said that this ceremony has to be done every single year. Right? You do it the first year, on the eve of the Exodus, and that every single year it's to be kept as an eternal ordinance. Verse 24, you shall observe this as an institution for all time. Right, here it is. For you and for your descendants. And when you enter the land that the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall observe this rite. And when your children ask you, what do you mean by this rite? You shall say it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but saved our houses. So it turns out, therefore, that in addition to the Paschal Lamb, in addition to the matzah, in addition to the bitter herbs, there's a fourth element to this night, which is the questions of the children. That's just as essential and just as mandated as anything else, the questions of the children and the answers of the parents.
By now, the way, the quoted question is the Rasha.
That's irrelevant for here, right? That's irrelevant for this, right? The children will say, what do you mean by this, right? And you have to give them an answer. Now, if it says the children are going to ask,
then you need asking.
Then you have to make sure that that happens. So there's an implication here. It's implied that you have to do something to make sure they ask. Now, it could very well be that the very fact you're eating this cardboard instead of bread, and you're eating this bitter herbs instead of vegetables, and instead of a normal meal, you're having a barbecue outside with your whole family, that's enough reason for them to start asking questions. But the idea is, if they don't, then you should do other things that are out of the ordinary to make sure they ask questions, and you should give them sufficient answers.
In verse 25, this punctuation.
For verse 25.
Yeah, this punctuation that tells us we're supposed to say it as Elohim.
The word of God? No, no,
no. No. Isn't there a punctuation when for the four-letter name that says you're supposed to pronounce it differently?
Very, very rarely. In the Torah, it appears in only one place, I think. It's in the prophets more.
Oh.
That's the new way it's normally...
What is he asking about?
About the word Hashem. But I'd like to... I want to run forward quickly because we have so much to do. We can talk about it later if you want. I want to go on to the same chapter in verses 43 to 48. The Lord said to Moshe and Aaron, "This is the law of the Passover offering. No foreigner shall eat of it. But any slave a man has bought may eat of it once he has been circumcised." Clearly, this is a law for the future, not for the present. It's when you keep this right another 50 years, another 100 years, another 1,000 years, another 2,000, it's telling us under what circumstances who can you invite to your Seder.
So that's very interesting because a lot of people invite non-Jews.
Absolutely. Right. Were we to have the Passover sacrifice, we couldn't invite non-Jews. And understand why it makes perfect sense. Because this is the celebration of the formation and renewal of Jewish identity. You can invite anyone you want to your Rosh Hashanah meal, but not to your Passover meal. Because the Rosh Hashanah meal is about individuals renewing their connection to God once a year. But the Passover meal is about Jews renewing their connection to the Jewish people once a year. It's certainly not fitting to invite anyone who's not part of that renewal. And by the way, when I first got to Dallas, I made a point of telling conversion candidates that we invite you for Shabbat, for holidays, for Pesach, you can't come. And that's based on the idea that this is a matter of renewal of Jewish vows. Now, halachically, you could invite non-Jews because we don't have the Passover sacrifice. But spiritually, I always felt that it was the wrong thing to do to invite conversion candidates. But I later changed my mind. Because although I think I was right ideologically, it was just too difficult for people. People broke down. They couldn't come to the Seder because for them, it's part of their process, became part of the Jewish people. So, back to reading these verses, which are very important. "But any slave a man has bought may eat of it once he has been circumcised." In the ancient times, acquiring a slave was making him part of the family, at least according to Jewish law. It has to be circumcised. Now, look what the Torah just did. This is fascinating. The Torah here couples the Passover lamb with circumcision. Why? Because these are the two positive mitzvot to the Torah that we can call meta mitzvot. They're prior to the mitzvot. These are the mitzvot that create Jewish identity. In the Torah, there is a punishment for not performing certain mitzvot called karet. And it doesn't matter what karet means. There's a big argument among the commentators. But what's clear is that it's the most serious punishment. And you know what? There's only two positive mitzvot. The punishment for not fulfilling them, which is karet. Only two of them. These two. Not circumcising and not eating the Paschal lamb when the time comes every year. And why these two mitzvot coupled and why they're so important? Because they're both the same thing. They're not mitzvot, they're meta-mitzvot. They're about creating Jewish identity. And if you don't do this mitzvot, then it's not that you haven't done a certain mitzvah. You're basically saying, I'd rather have stayed back in Egypt. I'd rather not be part of this people.
So that, in a way, we are all, since we don't have the Paschal lamp anymore, we are all doomed for karet.
You're right. In a certain sense, we're missing this fundamental sign of Jewish identity. It's not our fault. I hope it's not our fault.
Where do we get that punishment? Is that the Talmud? Is that where we get that?
No, it's in the Torah. It's not here. Is it here? Yes. No, it is here.
That's okay. I'm sorry.
Yes, it's not here.
Be another thing.
Given the criteria, though, couldn't the descendants of Keturah participate in the Pesach?
Ooh, that's a big question. No, don't
what?
Get me into that.
What did you say?
Don't even mention it. Very, very good. Wow, wow, that's a good point.
I'm sorry I missed the question.
I missed
the
question too.
Okay. So, no bound or hired labor shall eat of it. It shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any flesh outside the house, nor shall break any bone of it. The whole community shall offer it. If a stranger who dwells with you would offer the Passover to the Lord, all his males must be circumcised. Then he shall be admitted to offer it. He shall then be a citizen of the country. But no uncircumcised person may eat of it. That verse that I just read, verse 49, is actually the prototype of conversion. Look what it says. It says, if a stranger, the word in Hebrew is a ger, if he wants to, and he dwells with you, he's becoming part of the Jewish people, if he wants to offer the Passover lamb, what does it mean? If he wants to take part in this fundamental creation of Jewish identity, what does he have to do first? Males become circumcised. Then he shall be admitted to offer it. Then he shall be a citizen. That's conversion. This verse is the first mention, the first hint to the idea of conversion. And according to the Bible, conversion is made up basically of three things. Dwelling among you, circumcision, Passover lamb.
So if he has adult male children who choose not to be circumcised,
then they can't eat.
And he can't convert.
It says all males must be circumcised.
All his males must be circumcised.
Mm-hmm. Here they use the word proselyte very specifically.
I don't know. Oh, wait, I don't know. I mean, okay. I have to think about it. It's an interesting point. Yeah, so they explicitly say what it's become.
So they're not just talking about a stranger. This is somebody who is taking steps to doing exactly what you're saying.
Absolutely. The word stranger is really a bad translation. The word really means a sojourner, someone who's already taken steps to live among you. Absolutely. Okay, where are we now? Yeah. So, in a certain sense, you could say that when the Israelites left Egypt, and they were commanded at this last moment in Egypt to have this Passover lamb, what they were really doing was converting to Judaism. They were becoming Jews.
So in a way, all this group of slaves are becoming Jews at that point.
And every year,
we are re-becoming
Jews. Mm-hmm. It's a renewal of vows every year.
What were they before?
They were a tribe.
A riffraff.
Israelites.
They were what?
Riffraff.
Riffraff, okay, right. They were a safsuf. How do you say that in English? They were...
Riffraff.
Oh, that's an English word, riffraff.
Yeah.
I get mixed up in the languages. Because riffraff is so similar to asafsuf. It's alliteration.
Yes.
But you know, so if there's something that somebody has to say. It's so ironic. These people are celebrating their freedom. They're celebrating being allowed to leave slavery.
And they're getting circumcised.
Yet they have slaves. I mean, come on now.
Okay, so that's a fantastic point. I want to actually elaborate on that. It's not that they have slaves, because this verse that we just read is clearly for the future. They don't have slaves. But you're right that there's, in my mind, a terrible, terrible dissonance here. And perhaps it's even purposeful. Perhaps the Torah is trying to say something. At the very moment that we're talking about becoming free and leaving slavery behind, there's a verse that says, when you have slaves in the future. That dissonance is tremendously jarring. I was actually thinking of writing an essay about that.
You also talked a few weeks that there never really is freedom, not real freedom. You're never really free, we talked about.
There's always
accountability, there's always...
Okay, right, so that becomes part of the definition of freedom.
Exactly.
Well, and service means the same way that slavery refers to service, yeah.
Commandment to pray four times a day is also.
Four! You're adding commandments to commandments. It's only three. Shacharit, Mincha, and Ma'ariv. But don't make it four.
I thought four was in your traffic. You said, God, get out of this. No.
Okay, so let's go on now. We're going on to one more verse that's fundamental to the Seder. That's in chapter 13, verse 8. Chapter 13, verse 8. Indeed, it says... Verse 8, and you shall explain to your son on that day, Higata levincha b'yom mahu lemor, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I went free from Egypt. So again, we have this emphasis on intergenerational communication at the time of the Seder, when you do this ceremony. And even if the children don't ask, you should tell them. Right here, there's no question, but there's an answer. And what's terribly important in this one verse is the fact that it's in the first person. It's in the first person, not in the third person. Even though it says you should explain to your son on that day, meaning that day in the future, a long time from now, it might be 10 years from now, it might be 100, it might be 1,000, and it's been a long time since you've been a slave, it's been 1,000 years since you've been a slave, you should still say to your children, it's because of what the Lord did for me. And this matter of a conflation of identity, so that all the generations see themselves as part of the same story, as if they were there, that's of course what the rabbis say, b'chol dor v'dor, in every generation, one should see himself as if he personally went out of Egypt. And in English, there's a very, very cute way of saying this, and I brought it on the sheet at the top of the second one. His story must become my story, right? That's exactly what the rabbi is trying to say when they say that one should see himself as if he personally went out of Egypt. We have to have been there.
Nice. That's cute. Did you invent
it? I did not. Absolutely did not. So now, we have only 3 hours left, and we have a lot to do. What I wanted to do
3 hours?
Is to go through the whole Haggadah
in five hours.
I wanted to go through the whole Haggadah and help us to understand what parts of it come directly from the Bible and are therefore most central, and what parts of it don't come directly from the Bible and therefore are less central. From a traditional point of view, of course, at the Seder we want to go through the whole Haggadah, but on the other hand, it could be very difficult for families that don't know Hebrew and don't have a lot of background, and there's little children there, and there's many generations, people with no connection to tradition. So if you have to only pick certain matters from the Haggadah, it's good to know what is central. So to make a very long story short, at the beginning of the Haggadah, there's a table of contents, and we tell everyone the 12 steps of the Haggadah, and I put in bold-faced type the 4 steps that are central. What are they? Magid, Matzah, Maror, and Korek. Matzah means the eating of the Matzah. Mm-hmm. Maror means the eating of the Maror. The Korek means the eating of the Matzah and the Maror together. We eat them separately, then we eat them together. And that those are central elements of the Seder, because you're supposed to eat them, and it says in the Torah, eat them, so you have to eat them. The other element of the Seder, of course, besides the eating, is the telling of the story. As we saw in the verses, you have to have questions and answers. You have to tell the story. So let's spend as many minutes as we have before everyone has to run on the mitzvah of Magid, which is the telling of the story. So where does that begin? We won't talk about the kiddush, won't talk about the washing of the hands, won't talk about the vegetables, we won't talk about the break of the matzah. We'll go to the Magid, which is turning one page, where it says here, Magid. And it begins with, this is the bread of affliction, ha lachma anya, dachalu avatana bara de mitzrayim. This is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. And that does seem to be the beginning of actually the telling of a historical tale. However, I want to note that there's a lot of material here that's actually introductory. It's not yet the telling of the story. If I can just get that one point across, we'll have accomplished quite a bit. So this is an introduction. What comes next? It says, now the children asked Manishtana. Mm-hmm. So, Ilan, everyone has it on the sheets.
Ah!
Yeah. I want, the reason I did it on the sheets is so everyone can take it home. So when it says, now the children asked Manishtana, what's happening is the follows. Obviously, before you tell the story, the children are supposed to ask. The story is in response to the questions. According to all of the rabbinic material, it's very clear that the best case scenario is a Seder in which the children do not ask Manishtana. Do not ask Manishtana. Why? Because the Manishtana is a choreographed, rote recital of questions. And questions should never be recited by rote. Questions should be spontaneous. The idea of the Seder is to behave in a fashion in which the children are naturally curious and questions are inspired by what's going on. We eat the Passover sacrifice, not these days, but they used to. You have the matzah, you have the maror. And you do, and you're supposed to do many other out-of-the-ordinary things so that the children will become involved. What happens is that if you fail and the children don't become involved and don't ask, then the Torah gives you a stopgap measure. Have them recite from the book. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. What they have in the Talmud is the following. The Talmud says that after you begin the meal, after you sit down and make kiddush, you're supposed to take away all the food and take away all the dishes. And the children are supposed to say, "What's going on here? I heard we're having a really big meal. It's the Seder night, and you prepared the table, and now you're taking it away before we've eaten." And then the Talmud says, you say to the children, "You've exempted us from saying Manish Tana. We don't have to read the questions because you have your own." Indeed so. And that's the way we used to do in our house. And there was no need for Manish Tana. And the kids were 4, 5, 6. We'd set the whole table, get ready, sit down, and then take it all away. And they go crazy. What's going on?
It's not the principle of teaching children. First, they learn the alphabet. Right? So you're teaching them, they memorize the alphabet. Then they learn how to read. So this is...
But even, before they read
this in my memory, then they learn how to ask questions.
Okay, fine. So anyway, the ideal is not to use Manish Tana. I understand if the kids learned it in kindergarten, they'll be tremendously disappointed if they don't get to ask it, but they should certainly be asking other questions, and that's why the plastic green frogs that they sell in Judaica stores for Seder, and the fake blood and all the other implements, that's not newfangled changes to Judaism. That's what the Talmud says you should do. You should do funny, crazy things to arouse the children. Right? You should grab the matzah, says the Talmud. You should give out nuts and
our kids like the hail.
Roasted stuff. They like the what?
The hail,
right? That's all you're supposed to do. So then it says here, I'm turning the page to the next page. I'm in the fifth line. We were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and the Lord our God took us out from there with a strong hand and outstretched arm. If the Holy One, blessed be He, had not taken our fathers out of Egypt, then we, our children, our children's children, would have remained enslaved to Paro in Egypt. Even if all of us were wise, all of us understanding, all of us knowing the Torah, we'd still be obligated to discuss the exodus from Egypt, and everyone who discusses the exodus from Egypt at length is praiseworthy. What I just read is not a fulfillment of the commandment to tell the story. It's rather an introduction telling you that you should do this mitzvah at length. But it's not yet the mitzvah itself. So this is all background. These are pedagogical instructions. And if there's something that you have to delete from your Seder because of lack of time, then you delete the pedagogical instructions. You could have read this the day before. I'm not telling you that traditionally you read it the day before. I'm telling you that if you have to cut things out, then you cut out the pedagogical instructions. And what you want to keep in is the actual answers to the questions we didn't get yet. Didn't get to yet. Next paragraph. It happened to Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azari, and Rabbi Kivin, Rabbi Tarfon, who were reclining the Seder in Bnei Brak. They're discussing the exodus from Egypt all that night. So why do we say that?
Pep talk to us.
It's a pep talk to the adults that you have to put a lot of energy into it. But it's not the thing itself. It's rather a pedagogical comment. Next, the same thing also. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, I'm like a man of 70 years old, and that's a midrash that says you should talk about the exodus all the time. Again, it's a, like Ilana said, it's a pep talk, but it's not the thing itself. Then we go on. Let's go on to the paragraph, blessed is the omnipresent one, blessed is he who gave the Torah to his people Israel, blessed is he. The Torah speaks of four children, wise, wicked, simple, and doesn't know how to ask. That is a midrash of the four sons. And what it basically says is, every child has to be answered on his own level. Is that the mitzvah? No. It's pedagogical instruction. It's not of the essence. You should do what it says, but reading it is not the point. The point is performing the mitzvah that's about to come according to these instructions. But the mitzvah has not come yet. Next, that same midrash goes on the whole page. top of the next page. In the beginning, our fathers served idols. But now the omnipresent one has brought us close to his service, and has said, etc. What I'll just say is, this is also not yet the mitzvah of telling the story, but it's also not anymore pedagogical advice. Now it's context. It's putting the story we're about to tell into a larger historical context. That the story of slavery to freedom should be seen in the context of idolatry to monotheism. But it's not yet the story. And we go on. The story finally begins in the bold face. That's where the story finally begins.
Oh,
if you only have half an hour, let's say that you're doing the Seder in your when you're in the middle of battle in Lebanon or in Germany, wherever it might be, you only have half an hour, that's where the Seder begins. That's where Magid, the mitzvah of Magid begins, the mitzvah of telling the story. The children ask their questions in response to all your things you did, and then the telling of the story begins with that verse. That verse is a quote from Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 26. And Deuteronomy chapter 26... It's related to Shavuot. There's a 4-verse section in Deuteronomy chapter 26 that describes the Exodus in 4 verses. Just let me show you those verses. Here's the first verse. Mm-hmm. Here's the second verse. In boldface, turn the page. Here is the 3rd verse in boldface, and here's the 4th verse. Those 4 verses in Deuteronomy tell the whole story. How does this work? It works as follows. We all know that in the book of Exodus, chapters 1 to 13, is the full play-by-play, blow-by-blow description of the Exodus, right? From slavery to freedom. 12, 13 long chapters. It's all there. Why don't we just read those 13 chapters at the Seder?
Yeah.
The answer to that is twofold. We don't read them because it's too long, which would mean if you read it, you'd be reading a story, and you wouldn't be telling a story. The second reason, I'll explain why we don't read those verses, is because they're in the third person, not the first person. You want to tell your story. What we do is we use these 4 verses from Deuteronomy that summarize the story. These verses are in the first person. And the rabbis chose these verses so you can tell what happened to you, what happened to me when I was there. Secondly, these 4 verses are only 4 verses. They summarize the story in a truncated fashion. And therefore, when the rabbi said, use these verses to tell the story, they're forcing you to fill in the missing information in your own words. So it becomes a telling and not a reading. And it becomes a telling of a personal story and not someone else's story. And the way the Haggadah is set up, now turn the page back, The way the Haggadah is set up, beginning with the first verse, and I'll read the verse from the middle of it. My father went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, became there a nation great, mighty, and numerous. Then what does the Haggadah do? It quotes 5 words from the verse and explains them. Another 4 words and explains them. Another 3 words and explains them. Another 5 words and explains them. Another 2 words and explains. Another 2 words explains. When it finishes the explanation, it quotes the next verse. You with me? Quotes the next verse, the bottom of the page, and then takes the verse apart, quotes it word by word, and explains what's going on. It's a midrash on the 4 verses in Deuteronomy. Why a midrash? Because this is meant to be an example of what you should do at your Seder. Take those 4 verses, take them apart, explain them in your own words, based on your own experience, based on your own understanding, based on your comprehension of what the needs of the people in the room are and how they'll be able to relate to it. What you're not supposed to do is read the Midrash. If you read the Midrash, you might as well have read the verses from Exodus that tell the story, because you're not supposed to read, you're supposed to tell your own story. This Midrash is an example. But if you read it by rote, you've done exactly the opposite of the whole idea. So if you really want to read it, if you feel you'll break interest, don't read it, but you also have to then make a midrash on the midrash that you're that you're reading. It has to be real. It has to be your own experience. You bring into it things that you understand from what you've gone through in life, the meaning of freedom, the meaning of slavery, and you take out the albums that you have from the times you were slaves in Egypt. You show it to the kids. You explain the pictures. There I was, and look how old I was, and look how young I was, etc., etc., etc. It's supposed to be a living experience. And we'll end by just pointing out that after this is over, and it's over here on the page that begins with the great manifestation with signs and wonders, those are the last words of that four sentence section of Deuteronomy. Then the rest of this page is explanation of the signs and wonders, the blood, right, and the fire and the wild beasts. It's all a midrash on what the signs and wonders were. And then we go on, next page of the song Dayenu, which is part of telling the story. And then the next page has on it boldface, Rabban Gamliel. What's happening now is a second telling of the story in a different fashion. The first telling was chronological, a midrash based on the four verses in Deuteronomy. This happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. The second telling of the story is in a different fashion. The second telling of the story is explanation of the foodstuffs on the table. Rabban Gamliel says, whoever does not discuss the following three things on Pesach has not fulfilled his duty, namely Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. And then we go on and point at the Pesach, Matzah, and Maror and explain their meaning. That's a second way of telling the story, and it's also mandated. And that is the second important element, the second biblical element of the night. So again, the first element was telling the story based on Deuteronomy. The second important element is telling the story based on the three foodstuffs. And then the rest of the Seder, the rest of the biblical part of the Seder, is eating the foodstuff, the matzah and the maror. That's it.
But we're only required to do the stuff in bold.
I'm not saying required. I'm saying if time is short and you can't do it, then here's the bare bones. You should do everything if you can, if it can be meaningful at this time.
How long does it take to do everything?
Say it again?
How long does it take to do everything?
It could be done an hour and a half. It could be done in 6 hours. I've seen both.
Yeah, I've done both.
This Passover is also Shabbos?
This Passover is Friday night.
You should keep in mind.
What's special is that you can't make the salt water on Shabbat. You have to do it before Shabbat because... and you can't cook. Usually you can cook on Yom Tov, but you can't cook on Shabbat. Right? What are the differences are there?
So you cook then for the two Seders before Shabbos.
Well, you can, the second day of Passover, which is Saturday to Sunday night, you can cook then.
Yeah.
But you can't cook on Friday night to Saturday night because it's Shabbat.
So the first Seder is Friday night?
First Seder is Friday night.
The second Seder is Saturday night. So before Shabbos, you should cook for both the Seder.
In Israel, do you do two Seder?
In Israel, we only do one Seder.
One Seder.
Right. And something I didn't mention, we didn't have time, but if Bob's asking what's special this year, one thing that's